This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. Heroin dealing and the addiction and crime that come with it are not new problems, and they're not specific to Vermont. Communities all across the country are dealing with upticks in heroin use, and in each instance, law enforcement is playing catch-up, trying to find new strategies for dealing with an all-too-familiar issue. But Vermont has stood out in one sense. Governor Peter Shumlin devoted nearly his entire State of the State speech in 2014 to the opioid and heroin scourge, and that made news in national media outlets as well as here locally. The idea that a state many from away think of as linked with idyllic rolling hills, rural charm, and Ben and Jerry's was very much at odds with a problem more normally associated with big urban cities that are already experiencing high rates of crime and violence. But that's what happened since Governor Shumlin's call for action against drug dealing and addiction has happened. It's not exactly encouraging. Nearly 2 years on since that speech, law enforcement agencies in Vermont are still dealing with high rates of dealing with addiction and crime. And as we'll hear later in the show, a corresponding rise in sex trafficking. Joining us online to discuss the heroin problem first is Detective Lieutenant John Merrigan, commander of the Vermont State Police Narcotics Investigation Unit. And Detective Merrigan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, we also welcome your questions or comments on this issue. Have you seen a rise in heroin use in your community? Have things improved at all since the governor's State of the State speech? Have you or a loved one struggled with heroin addiction in the past? And what do you think could or should be done to stem the tide? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211, or writing an email to Vermont Edition's Facebook page or to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. Detective Merrigan, I want to start by asking whether the heroin problem in Vermont is really as serious as the governor depicted in his State of the State speech. And if so, have things improved at all as we sit here near the end of 2015?
Well, it was accurate. It is very accurate at the time, and it's accurate today. And whether or not things have improved depends on how you look at it. Certainly, the law enforcement response has improved. And we give a lot of credit to the governor for sort of ripping the scab off of this thing and putting it out there in the light where everybody could see it. For years and years, heroin addiction by its nature is a subculture type of community. And it's becoming less and less so because of the amount of exposure that it's got. We're doing a much better job at working together, at working with our federal partners here in Vermont to identify the traffickers and prosecute them more effectively than we have ever done before. But at the same time, there's more heroin here in Vermont today than there was 6 months ago. And 6 months ago, there was more heroin in Vermont than there was 6 months before that. So it's definitely an uphill battle.
Well, I mean, if the heroin usage is increasing, if the heroin is still coming in, as you say, more now 6 months than there were 6 months ago, do you see sort of an end to this problem, or is it just going to keep getting worse? And why isn't the law enforcement response you're talking about being effective?
Well, it's a small state with limited resources, and that's the first that's the first thing that I would throw out there. But my other partners in this, the education folks and the treatment folks, they would say the same thing. Law enforcement in and of itself is not going to solve the problem here. You can't arrest your way out of it. That's a phrase that's been kicked around for years now. But you can't treat your way out of it either, and we can't educate our way out of this problem here in Vermont. So one of the things that we've done here in Vermont effectively is to unify those three components. And we really do have a unified approach where we support each other, we listen to each other, and we work together to try to make this happen. And so when I say that I think that there's good things going to happen in the future, it's because of this fairly unique approach that we're using here in Vermont. And we're just small enough of a state where you have personal relationships with these people in the other areas, and we can get on top of it. But it's not going to happen overnight.
Is this problem evenly spread statewide, or are there particular sections of Vermont that are suffering worse than others?
It's evenly spread. Vermont gets a lot of attention because of the governor's speech. We've had some high-profile things happen in the last couple of years, but New Hampshire is in the same boat. Upstate New York is very similar. Population of users and drug dealers. Maine is similar as well.
Yeah, Governor Maggie Hassan just made a speech in New Hampshire, I believe, based on the uptick they're seeing in heroin usage. Where is the heroin coming from?
Most of the heroin that comes here in our part of New England, the majority of that is coming from one way or another from New York City. And almost all of the heroin that we're seeing in the United States on our part of the country, on the eastern seaboard, is coming from either Mexico or Central America. So a lot of people think Afghanistan, that type of heroin is not coming here. So everything we're seeing is coming up from that part of the world. And it gets most of it gets distributed through the New York City area and then goes out from there. Now, there's a lot of different ways to traffic heroin, and I've learned a lot in the last couple of years about how easy that is to accomplish if you have a plan.
You know, I understand the motivation is fairly simple on this, that dealers can command a higher price for the drug here than they can in places like New York City because there's less competition driving the prices downward. If this is the case, though, it's a small state. We know basically where the heroin is coming from. Why is interdiction so difficult? In other words, stopping it before it gets in.
Well, the primary problem we have with that is that we, as Vermonters, provide the infrastructure to traffic the heroin. Classic drug dealing, especially as it pertained to distributing on decent levels, usually involved a group of people coming from out of the area, setting up shop, and five or six people would work together to distribute drugs. That's not how it's happening now. One person will come from out of the area, a place where they have contacts, where they can buy large amounts of heroin at wholesale prices. They can come to Vermont, and then we as Vermonters provide a place for them to stay, companionship, customers, vehicles to either use or we'll drive them around. And we do this because we're a consumer state and we have a high level of addicts here. And if we cooperate with the dealers, we'll get our heroin either for free or at a much more reduced rate. And if you have a habit, that's very attractive.
Well, what about the demand problem? I mean, if the demand for heroin is always going to trump the best efforts of law enforcement, what's the best way to intercede?
Well, it's a great question, and that's a question that we are constantly working on and changing as things progress. You know, the treatment portion here in Vermont is so important, and if you have, I've been a police officer for 22 years, I think, been doing drug investigation for most of my career with the state police, and if you've got a drug cop like me saying, "Hey, treatment is the most important thing that we can do," for our community here in Vermont, then it's probably true. If I could wave a magic wand and do one thing, I would make it so that everybody had treatment available to them the minute that they wanted to go. Of course, that's what it's all about getting somebody in that moment. We're really not interested in putting anybody in jail that has a heroin habit. That's the number one problem we have here, and our treatment folks do a great job. Limited resources.
Okay, I want to go to the phones. We've got a caller on the line. John is on the line from Burlington. John, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, I don't agree with you, officer. I think that there have been, since Governor Shumlin's efforts have been directed in the manner that you have pursued, I think that there have been countless innocent victims, including myself, and I could go into detail, but there certainly isn't time, and I don't think that funds for treatment are there for anything from cannabis, cannabinoids, to opioids, from lysergic acid diethylamide, which is being re-promoted at this time by the medical community, there's a constant switch off. It's as if the medical community and policing community are running a marathon, and there's a handoff on commercial futures.
Okay, John, I'm gonna let you leave that there because I want to give Detective Merrigan a chance to respond. Although I do think the detective has said that if he had his way, treatment would be an option for everyone. It does sound, Detective Merrigan, like John is saying that so far, whatever police have been doing, law enforcement hasn't been getting the job done. What would you say to him and someone who has struggled with addiction?
I think that's an understandable point of view. One of the issues as a law enforcement officer that it occurs to me when I hear somebody like John is that addiction is a social problem. It's not really a law enforcement issue that we're designed to solve. And a lot of times that gets put in our plate, like, what are you going to do about the amount of demand for it? And that's not something that we do well at. You know, that's not really a specialty of ours, and it's not something that I don't think we do a very good job. But if I'm hearing John correctly, if he's frustrated that the treatment options aren't as good as he could be, he's right.
We also have John on the line from Bethel. John, thanks for being with us here on Vermont Edition.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Given the ease of availability and the lack of adequate illicit drug trade enforcement, there are no programs in our country that allow poor, addicted, or anybody that's mentally ill to have access to long-term mental health care or legal prescription doses other than methadone and Suboxone. Heroin, which is supplied to intractable addicts and paid for long-term in-house treatment, is provided by most, if not all, European countries. And many young people are always going to be tempted to try this stuff despite the consequences. And why are they in so need of happiness? That's the problem. Why would they be in so need of happiness? Hence the reason for over 50 million smokers, 1 billion worldwide, and many more millions of alcohol drinkers and pot smokers. There will always be an addiction. Some are productive, some are not. And I have known many who have been involved with one substance abuse or another. My kid brother became an iconic street person, hooked on speed, lasting 38 years before passing away at 58. The only law he broke was that from loitering and bizarre behavior. The over-the-counter inhalers he broke open to drink from were legal. So we need to have mental health care for these people. They're looking for happiness. The issue is why are they so unhappy that they need this stuff to maintain that happiness?
John, I want to thank you very much for that call. And Detective Merrigan, I think John brings up a really interesting point, but I don't know that it's one that your department can tackle or has the time to. Or I wonder, do you ever discuss that, the questions among law enforcement, why people seek out drugs? What's missing in their life that they feel this need to take such dangerous drugs like heroin?
You know, I don't think we talk about it quite like John described, mostly because that's not our arena.
Right.
But what we do talk about is the difference in the availability. When I grew up in the 80s. I graduated high school, I think, in 87. It was not uncommon. I mean, that was, if we were going to do something, we would drink some beer. We, you know, liquor was the what we did, the illegal thing that we weren't supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
But today's 18-year-old, heroin is easier to get than a six-pack of beer. And I'm not trying to be an alarmist. That's a fact. It's easier to get than beer. So some of these things that John described, they're happening, but because the availability is so, it's so prevalent.
I want to go back to the phones. Josh is on the line from Burlington. Hi, Josh.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was... I wanted to call in to bring up the issue of legalization, and also that, you know, from what you just said, heroin being easier to get than a six pack, it would kind of point to, you know, the fact that we're losing the battle, that cops are behind the dealers, and it's always going to be a game of catch up. And I also want to draw attention to the fact that this is costing lives. One of my best friends passed away from a heroin addiction, and I feel that the system of prohibition and fighting it and making it illegal only perpetuates the ability for it to be unregulated, the ability for dealers to make money off of it. And if it were to be made legal and monitored, not only would you have more money for treatment, but you would also have a regulated product that less people would overdose on because they would know exactly how strong the heroin is.
Josh, thank you very much for that call. That's a very interesting point that Josh is bringing up, Detective Merrigan, and certainly some libertarian politicians have even mentioned that legalization might be the way to go. On the face of it, that seems a bit strange with a drug as dangerous as heroin. Let me ask you, if heroin was legalized, do you think it would make your job easier or more difficult?
You know, I guess I don't really know if I have a really good response for that. I've heard the legalization arguments many times. I'm familiar with a couple of countries in Europe that run with a program like that, and some of that has been successful. Whether that would relate to our culture here and our current laws, I don't know how much we would have to change and have a steady change in place before we did a legalization for that to be effective. But again, it's not my area either.
Right now, you're dealing with what you have to deal with, which is your task, which is to go after drug dealers. And unfortunately, as you said, you would rather see treatment options, but you've got to arrest those who use as well. I mean, you can't stop doing your job, right?
Yeah, that's right. So it's a line between identifying people that are solely distributing for personal profit, and that's easy, of course, for us. That's somebody that we want aggressive prosecution and to get them off the streets. And the tricky one is the person that is doing it for profit, but most of that profit is going in to fund their own habit. That's one that you have to really weigh, and that's, of course, it's not up to the police. It's up to the prosecution and the judicial system to decide what type of punishment they get. But that's the grayer area. But certainly, even the worst dealer who was addicted, we still want that guy to get treatment, because when he gets out, if he still has an addiction problem, then it's going to repeat itself, and that's what we see over and over again.
One more question, Detective Merrigan. We've been talking about the need for treatment. You've been talking about getting this problem out into the spotlight. And I think that you mentioned that the thing you liked about the governor's speech was that it was ripping the scab off this issue and putting it out there. Is this something that we need to talk about more as a community in order to get past a certain hump that will get us to deal with it more directly?
Oh, it absolutely is. That maybe is the biggest point, is that we all need to talk about it, have real conversations with each other. I guarantee that everybody that's listening to this program knows somebody they care about, somebody they love, that has a heroin problem. It's a part of the country that there really isn't anybody that's exempt from this. No type of family, no socioeconomic group is exempt from this. It's happened in my family. People that I really care about have struggled with this. It's a real problem, and if we don't have real conversations with each other and really look at what our kids are doing and what our loved ones are doing and our friends are doing, and have real conversations with them, then it's not going to get any better. And I do think that's changing. I do think those real conversations and the people walking with their eyes more open to this problem is taking place.
Detective Lieutenant John Merrigan, commander of the Vermont State Police Narcotics Investigation Unit, I want to thank you so much for taking the time today.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And coming up in the program, we'll be looking at a corresponding issue that's become linked to heroin, sex trafficking. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking today about crime and addiction associated with heroin in Vermont. And sadly, we also have to talk about it in tandem with another serious problem, and that's sex trafficking. We have two guests with us now in the studio to help us understand why and how these two illegal activities are increasingly becoming linked. Eric Miller is U.S. Attorney for the District of Vermont. Thanks so much for being with us today.
It's our pleasure. Thank you.
And Heather Ross is an Assistant U.S. Attorney and co-chair of the Vermont Human Trafficking Task Force. Heather, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having us.
We want to hear from you as well. If this has become a problem in your community, sex trafficking, maybe you know someone who's had to deal with this issue, a family member, a loved one, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Write to us at our Vermont Edition Facebook page or post an email to vermontedition@vpr.net. Eric Miller, I want to start with you. Have sex trafficking and heroin distribution always been problems that show up together, or is this more of a new phenomenon?
Mitch, we made a PSA regarding this dangerous intersection of heroin trafficking and sex trafficking because we did see an uptick in the incidence of this type of victimization among the cases that we're prosecuting and investigating in our office. And we felt it was really important to draw attention to this intersection for a couple of reasons. One, we want people to recognize this type of victimization when it is occurring in their communities and among their loved ones so that we can better prevent it. And number two, we wanted to be able to put victims and potential victims in touch with the many, many services that are out there for them.
Heather Ross, give me an idea here of how this is linked together. I mean, I have to admit, I feel a little naive. I never associated these two problems. I thought of them as very separate things. How is heroin addiction, the crime associated with it, becoming linked with sex trafficking?
That's a great question. The way that the two appear to becoming linked is the fact that they both are ultimately about traffickers profiting, traffickers making money. And the two intersect because traffickers are able to use drug addiction and the ability to increase or feed someone's addiction as a tool to ultimately control that person and compel them to do commercial sex acts as another way to make money for the trafficker.
Is this primarily a problem with women, or do we see it with men as well?
It certainly can be a problem for both men and women. We, in our office to date, have seen more cases that involve women than men, but we are confident that it affects both men and women.
We're dealing with vulnerable people here, and that's really the main point that you're making. Someone who may have a drug addiction problem may be compelled to do something in the sexual arena they don't want to do.
That's absolutely correct. And so traffickers prey on anyone with vulnerabilities, and those who are addicted to drugs, that's a vulnerability.
Eric Miller, again, this is something that surprises me. I always imagine something like this would happen in a place like New York, Los Angeles. How can this be happening in a small rural state like Vermont?
Well, as Detective Lieutenant Merrigan just said during the last segment, drug addiction, it doesn't respect those sorts of differences of geography, of race, of socioeconomic status. It can afflict anybody, and it afflicts Vermonters at the same rate it afflicts others. And as Heather pointed out, when someone is addicted to drugs or otherwise indebted to a drug dealer who's in the business to make money, that exposes vulnerabilities that allow the drug dealer to put pressure on them. Sometimes the coercion takes the form, traditional form, of violence or threats of violence, but far more often it's taking a more subtle form of relationship pressure accompanied by false promises of maybe a more exciting life or a better life. And then, as Heather pointed out, so often we see that drug dealers are providing heroin and then withholding the heroin to which users have become addicted as a coercive tool to require them to perform sex that really benefits the drug organization.
We're speaking with Eric Miller, U.S. Attorney for the District of Vermont, and Heather Ross, Assistant U.S. Attorney and Co-Chair of the Vermont Human Trafficking Task Force. You can join the conversation at 1-800-639-2211. Write to us at our Vermont Edition Facebook page or Vermont Edition at vpr.net. I want to play a piece of tape for both of you here, and this is from the website for the new awareness campaign about the drug trade and sex trafficking. It's called YouCanStopTraffic.org. You can listen to audio of three women talking about their own experiences. And here's a little bit of one woman's story. It's from Megan McCarthy, a young woman who lives in Baltimore, Vermont.
15 is when I started doing Percocet. And then at 18, I was doing heroin every day. I'll be 22 next month. I was introduced to people up here who were selling drugs and stuff. And then one of my friends started prostituting, and that's kind of how I got into that. A girl I knew from high school was with the same people that I was with, and we ended up going to Connecticut and being pimped out. We didn't really even get to keep any of our money or anything. And he kept saying, oh, we'll go home in the morning, we'll go home in the morning. But we were with him for a week and a half until I got arrested. It just opened my eyes to this is how bad things can be, and this is how bad things will be if I continue using. And I think sometimes I'm what can I do to stop this from happening to other people? And especially since I have a daughter, I think sometimes that's what scares me.
Heather Ross, that's a tough story to hear, but as tough as it was to hear, it also sounds like Megan got the help that she needed. What should a woman in her situation do? Where should she go first if she wants to get out and get help?
That's a great question. So One of the places that she can go that we've set up through the Human Trafficking Task Force is to dial 211, where the caller can be linked with resources from medical treatment to housing, to making a report to law enforcement, if that's what he or she chooses to do, but a whole range of resources. You can also go to Give Way to Freedom's website. They are a Vermont nonprofit organization with whom we partner, devoted exclusively to human trafficking issues. And finally, on the website, you can stoptraffic.org. We have listed and identified resources where people can turn for help.
Okay, and we'll put links to that on our website as well at vpr.net. Eric Miller, what is the strategy that your office is using now to make sure that we don't hear more stories like Megan's?
So we hear a lot in talking about heroin about a three-legged stool approach. We have law enforcement. We have treatment. We have education. When it comes to this particular aspect of the drug trade, the approach is really the same in its generalities. Number one, we as an office are investigating and prosecuting human traffickers, drug dealers who coerce others into performing sex, commercial sex. But that's only part of the equation. The second thing we're doing is education. And the PSA that we're here talking about today is one of the main components of our education, but it's not the only component. Heather, her colleagues at the Attorney General's office, and others in the law enforcement and nonprofit community sit on Vermont's Human Trafficking Task Force. Their educational efforts have been aimed not just at the general public, but also to law enforcement officers who are better, as a result of that education, able to recognize sex trafficking when they see it accompanying drug trafficking. And then finally, we do want to put people in touch with treatment. 211, Give Way to Freedom, and the other organizations that are listed on our PSA's website, youcanstoptraffic.org, help accomplish that goal.
We've got a caller on the line from Killington. Gordon is on the line. Gordon, thanks for being with us.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm a builder, and we had renovated a storefront on Route 4 in Rutland several years ago that had a glass front that looked directly at Route 4 across from, let's say, a certain hotel. We watched the gentleman come out every morning, sit in his lawn chair. Another gentleman would come on a bicycle every hour, pick up the drugs. It was obvious, and was ferrying them for delivery. The roofers that were doing the roof on the house or on the building were from Bennington. They needed to spend the night at the hotel to get the job done. Just down the road, they spent the night at a hotel. There was two rooms with prostitutes in them doing their tricks all night long. This went on for 2 weeks, and then when they were done, the girls would move to another hotel that's literally 100 feet down the road to avoid detection. And this is all within 500 yards of the Rutland High School. And in that time, we very rarely saw any police presence.
Gordon, did anyone from the crew make an attempt to talk to law enforcement and get them out there and let them know what was happening?
We did at one point. I mean, it's a tricky slope situation where, you know, what do you do? Do we call the Rutland police and inform them that there's prostitution going on at this hotel? You know, it's kind of a sketchy situation. Do we call them and tell them at the other hotel we're witnessing drug acts? I've never had to do that. This was a very big eye-opener for me. I've lived here my whole life, and this was obvious. It was just right in front of us. I was appalled.
Well, Gordon, thank you very much for the call. Eric Miller, you want to react to what Gordon's saying?
Sure. I think Gordon's experience points out just how important it is that every Vermonter be vigilant about this and that they do call law enforcement when they see signs that either drug trafficking or sex trafficking is occurring. This is an all-hands-on-deck problem, and the responsibility for solving it, of course, falls primarily to those of us in law enforcement, treatment, and education, but it's a responsibility that's shared by every Vermonter.
It might be a little intimidating, though, for folks, too, to even make that call. Sure, I mean, you know, you want to remain anonymous, you probably will be, but can you assure people that maybe afraid of getting involved with that kind of element, that they're going to be safe? It's okay to call.
Law enforcement is well trained to take in information from the public in a way that protect the community partners that we need in order to combat this?
Let's move on and ask. Let me ask about this, Heather. You know, there is a certain economic incentive here. I mean, as harsh as that sounds to say, there's a demand for drugs. There's a demand for sex. What about the economic circumstances there? And is this really just people from poor economic circumstances who are vulnerable here?
Just as Detective Merrigan said earlier, this really crosses all socioeconomic groups. So it is not just those who are more economically challenged that are vulnerable to being part of this. As we know, drug addiction doesn't respect or maintain those kind of distinctions. So vulnerabilities are not just limited to certain groups of people in terms of this problem.
Eric Miller, what about the people who look for paid sex workers? Have there been efforts to go after the so-called John Does who illicit women for paid sex? And have those efforts worked in the past?
So we at the U.S. Attorney's Office are in charge of enforcing federal law. As a result, our office is not regularly involved in questions of prostitution. There is a difference between prostitution and sex trafficking, and that generally takes the form of threats, coercion, or fraud that induces someone against their will to become involved in the sex trade. That is where we as federal law enforcement authorities have focused our efforts because it's where the federal law gives us the most tools to work with.
Let me ask this question for both of you. You know, there is this economic incentive I've been talking about, and I'm curious about the alliance here between sex traffickers and drug dealers, because I would imagine that when it comes to the profits, they would become rather greedy and parochial about, you know, sharing those profits. And yet there's an alliance that's been formed here. Is that right?
Well, I'll take the first stab at answering that. In fact, what we are finding is that drug traffickers and sex traffickers are the same person or persons in most cases. Mm. It's not that they have formed alliances. It's, to put it in business terms, it is more that a drug dealer has expanded his or her business model to include sex trafficking, or somebody who started as a sex trafficker realizes how key drugs are to making his or her profit and to furthering the trade or business that he or she's in.
I want to get one more caller in here, and I believe that she prefers to remain anonymous. Thanks very much. You're on the line with us here on Vermont Edition. Go ahead.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, good. Thanks for your call.
Let's see. I just wanted to call in just that comment about, you know, people coming from all different socioeconomic backgrounds. And, you know, these women may be, this is something I've unfortunately been involved with personally. And, you know, this may be someone who you went to graduate school with. This may be someone that you had a really good job with who, you know, lost their job and then ended up finding themselves in a situation like that, you know, due to the fact that you know, their economic, everything changed. They lost their job, they lost their house, and they find themselves in a situation like that. And I just call in to say, you know, that could be like your sister or, you know, like somebody that you know, as opposed to when I hear this on the radio, I often think of like young girls who, you know, who come from low socioeconomic backgrounds who found themselves in this situation. And, you know, it just isn't that person. So just, I don't know, I call to say that.
And you've dealt with this yourself personally?
I have, and I have known people in this, you know, in this situation. And again, like when I see stuff like this on TV, I typically think exactly what you guys were saying, like, you know, in New York or, you know, I envision the type of women or girls that I would assume would be those type of people. And it doesn't, it hits everybody. Like they're saying, you know, it hits, it doesn't matter what your race or your background or, you know, your economic status is. And so I say that because it could hit home with anybody.
Thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate it. We have just about a minute here, Heather and Erica. I just want to finish up with you. What would you say to a woman like our caller here, you know, who has been involved in this life, wants to get out? What is the message that needs to be delivered here to folks who might be vulnerable?
I think the overall message, the overarching message that we want to deliver, Mitch, is we want to provide you with the resources that you need so that when you choose to get out, when others who love you help you choose to get out, you know who to call, and that you know that when you call, you're going to be given the help you need, not targeted by law enforcement or others.
Heather?
That's a great point. We would encourage people to, again, call 211. You had mentioned earlier, Mitch, that some people may be intimidated to call law enforcement. 211 is not law enforcement. It is callers trained to help you, connect you with resources.
Eric Miller is U.S. Attorney for the District of Vermont. Heather Ross is an assistant U.S. attorney and co-chair of the Vermont Human Trafficking Task Force. Difficult topic, but I want to thank you both so much for bringing it to light today on Vermont Edition. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up, you can find plenty of artwork depicting rolling hills, covered barns, and cows lazing in pastures in Vermont. But artist Tom Latham has been painting watercolors of less idyllic scenes of Vermont, old industrial buildings. And we'll speak with him about why they depict their own kind of beauty. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. A rolling brook, a classic New England white steeple church, an old covered bridge amid a backdrop of brilliant fall foliage. These are not the images that Vermont artist Tom Latham is interested in. He's also an architect, and they're not what you'll see at his exhibition currently on display at the Bennington Museum. Instead, Latham's watercolors give a visual voice to Vermont's industrial past. Old, often run-down mills and other large, hulking facilities that may not evoke the bucolic scenes most people think of when they envision the Green Mountain State, but are nevertheless very much a part of its identity. Tom Latham joins us now on the line. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, good to be here.
So, Tom, what interested you first about these buildings?
Well, they're hiding in plain sight. I mean, we have blinders on, you know. We have blinders. And then every once in a while, you'll remember driving through Eden, Vermont on a dirt road and coming to a six-story asbestos processing plant in the middle of nowhere. Discovering in Barton, Vermont, what, village of 350? I might be wrong. There was a piano manufacturer there. And these buildings just so beautifully, in a way, blend into the landscape that we don't see them.
Did you go looking for these buildings? Or, as you said, you were just traveling around the state and they started to catch your eye?
I started stumbling upon them. I actually was on a trip to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I discovered the mine heads for the copper and just was just astounded by the real beauty of this architecture of necessity, rather than trying to look pretty. It just shows its muscles. And also, it fits the landscape. And what is so wonderful about it is that you can see the hand of man on it. You can see somebody put all of those bricks in there. And all of the woodworking and so forth is pretty phenomenal.
And is that where you find the beauty in these buildings, the fact that they were crafted by hand, that they had to be built, as you say, the architecture of necessity?
Yeah, and there's a wonderful building down in Tunbridge. It's a mill building. It started out as a grist mill. And they added on a wood shop and, you know, a logging operation. And to make the building work, they did this very unique edition, which is kind of looks like a Pokemon edition. You know, it's like this larger building consuming the other small building. And it's probably one of the most unique vernacular buildings in the state. And what's so interesting is that it's in a historic district, which is composed of a covered bridge and a miller's cottage. And this building is so stunning that when I wanted to depict it, I basically did an outline of the miller's cottage and the covered bridge because they're generic. I mean, they're all over the place, or not all over the place, but they're significant numbers. And they and then this one building was really kind of what caught my eye and was what I was staring at. Getting back to how did I find these? Well, some people directed them to me. You know, there was one I went up to Space Research up on the Canadian U.S. border, which was an arms dealer. And it's amazing because the buildings were actually built in the late 60s, and they've fallen in. And, you know, there's a wonderful story about the site, about there was a customs station at either end of the driveway, you know, one on the U.S. side, one on the Canadian side, and what couldn't go out to the U.S. went out to the Canadian end. The Gerald Bull, the man who was the star, you know, this guy who made big artillery, and he made the mistake of selling one to Saddam Hussein. So
not what you want to be known for necessarily.
No, well, it's not what you want to be known for, but you know, you better have your life insurance paid up.
Well, you know, I'm curious too about your process here. I mean, when you found these buildings, did you paint them on site or take photos of them and paint them later?
Well, watercolors are tricky. You have to keep on working at them, and the work is fairly detailed, so the sun moves, so the light changes. So I'll do some studies of the work, except at when I was at the asbestos mine, when there was a Rottweiler that didn't look very friendly, and do some studies and then come back to the studio and work, because doing the basic work is about 12 to 16 hours to do the color part of it, and that's done continuously.
Yeah, and that's more than enough time for a mean Rottweiler to disturb your painting process.
Yeah. Dog cookies. Dog cookies are very important.
Dog cookies, absolutely. Why do you think these parts of our landscape are often ignored or avoided?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether it has to do with work or whether it has to do with they so fit into the landscape so well. You know, they're of a scale. They've, you know, rather than taking a bulldozer and flattening everything, they had to accommodate the land that they're on. And it's a great study in kind of landscape design, and, you know, which follows through in our villages and towns in Montpelier.
And I wonder if you'll get up to Burlington to get the Moran plant painted at any point.
Well, that's a possibility. I won't be doing any of the solar farms.
Architect and artist Tom Latham. You can find his watercolors and his show on display at the Bennington Museum. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Well, you're welcome. It's been fun.
That is Vermont Edition for today. We hope you'll join us tomorrow when we will take up the debate over a proposed carbon tax. Backers say it's needed to reduce carbon emissions in the state. It adds a major new tax to gasoline, diesel fuel, and heating oil to reduce consumption. Most of the new revenue will be used to cut other state taxes and fund energy efficiency projects. But the plan does have many critics. Send your questions or comments on the carbon tax to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the program today. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. Thanks so much for listening to Vermont Edition.